come now, all you mangy dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm. If your work be not too shoddy. Be careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. But Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Avast, me hearties. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network. Live streaming today from under clearly sprayed South Korean skies, you've tuned in to episode 45 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host and Chief Communications Officer, Jaffe Ryder. Hoisting our sails yet once again, today's guest is writer, producer, and host of the nighttime podcast, Halifax, Nova Scotia's very own Jordan Bone Party. With a lifelong interest in topics ranging from true crime, mysteries, the paranormal, and sometimes just plain downright weird, Show Chief Bone Party's recent investigative journeys were sparked by his chance discovery of a mysterious 65-year-old school journal and subsequent drawn-out search for its long-forgotten author. Since this time, he's been busied helping decipher and report on many of Canada's greatest ongoing mysteries, including the Shag Harbor UFO incident and Oak Island's purported legendary pirate treasure. I tell you, people, if there was ever a day to be producing and presenting a show such as the one that we have in store for you, here for you now, Friday the 13th would be 2017. That would be the day, I believe. So we're going to have Jordan Bone Party join us once again. I mean, you talk about a name for, if, as far as the pirate heritage is concerned, that seems to pretty much, that cuts it right there, obviously. But so the Oak Island mystery and the missing Templar fleet is really what we like to get into when it comes down to the heart of the topic material. But on top of that, maybe a little bit of the Shag Harbor UFO incident, too. That was quite something. And then, let's not forget, Jordan as well has researched, I think it's called the Bell Island Boom.
Boom.
There we go. So, hey, you know, Pirate Larry, we're going to actually just stand by for a second there, Jordan. We're going to actually have Pirate Larry just jump in. Just for a quick update from Ensenada, Baja. But Larry, we had a talk the other day, and you were mentioning that there's some not all is well in the state of Mexico at the moment. There's a little bit of upheaval and unrest, and people are making their voices known. Can you just give us our listeners a quick overview of what essentially perhaps they're not hearing about through the through the real news outlets?
Well, the Mexican peso has been devalued 73%. And they've decided that Wall Street wants Pemex, which is under the Constitution owned by the Mexican people. But Pemex has been fraught with a certain amount of fraud and corruption, and they haven't really, you know, acquired new technology, and so the idea is to produce more Mexican oil. But they raised the gas prices by 20% at the beginning of the year. So there have been protests where the protesters take over the toll roads, the toll gates, and they tell people to pass through for free and not pay the toll in protest of the gas hike. And then they're trying to privatize water. So I saw a video on Facebook. Unfortunately, they're hard to reproduce, you know, but this guy walks into the water district in Ensenada with a carton of eggs, and he starts going up to, you know, all the municipal employees' desks and smashing eggs on their desks and saying, "This is a peaceful protest. for you to get some huevos so that you will go and fight this, because if you allow the privatization of water, every single one of you will be out of a job. So get some huevos.
Meaning balls.
Yeah.
Get some balls. Huevos is
eggs. So balls. Right. So get some balls and start, you know, protesting this change of privatization of water. So with the peso devaluation and the gas increases, of course, food prices increase. Your purchasing power is less, and then the privatization of water, it goes against, you know, much of the revolutionary, spirit that was Mexico 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. You got people whose grandmothers remembered, Zapata.
Right.
So they're not that far away from, you know, the revolution.
And
it's been quite stormy.
Well, and how has the U.S., the big establishment media been? Have they been following this in any significant way, or has it just been really pretty much a non or secondary issue to what's going on currently throughout America?
I have found certain articles that are apologists for the Mexican government and the steps that they're taking to, quote-unquote, modernize their economy. It's the curse of neoliberalism forcing itself down on Mexico, and so it amounts to austerity. It amounts to taking Mexican oil and bringing it to market rates, whether the Mexican people can afford it or not, and allowing Nestle and Coca-Cola and the beer companies to privatize all the water.
Good old Nestle again, just like in California and elsewhere. So, hey, listen, Larry, we can pick up on that later. We can even do like an exclusive show on that. And of course, we'll put out a few maybe key, news links to the show notes if people are interested in following up on these stories. But, spotlight today, of course, is on our special guest, Mr. Jordan Bone Party from the Nighttime, podcast, based out of, Halifax, Nova Scotia. I think he's done up to 30 episodes by now is what his archive section looks like. I found it was BeanPod to be the most user-friendly as far from my end of things here. So a lot of great content there, Jordan. Thanks for dropping down and visiting us here in the docks of Skullport Harbor today.
My pleasure. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to hear, but I haven't heard of your show until I got your email recently, and I'm happy to have found out about it. Very cool what you have going on here.
Yeah, we were just kind of surfing around, and, you know, we're always headhunting, of course, so just took a look at what you had going there, and basically, once again, just stumbled across your project and started looking things over and thought, here's an undiscovered talent. This guy needs more promotion. So we can do that. We can give him a little more exposure. That's really what we're all about. We're in, you know, we're big into promoting the up-and-coming voices and personalities and, you know, projects that maybe are more kind of in the underground right now and the grassroots sort of level. Although you did get some exposure via CBC, I noticed. So maybe that might be a good place to start if you don't want to even just back things up a little further and kind of give us a quick overview of your childhood and what led you to, because I know that that book was a real pivotal discovery in this whole transition. Transitioning and awakening to all things mystery and so forth. But you had long had a passion and interest in true crime and just the paranormal and so forth. Is that not the case?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. This stuff, mysteries, true crime, paranormal stories, and just any weird or bizarre thing, that's always been what I've been interested in. I think a lot of it really started the boom as I entered adulthood and started to realize that the world is, you know, so fake and plastic and safe and boring. And I was kind of always looking for it, some type of adventure. So I kind of used my passion for, you know, the mysteries and the unusual to kind of be my medicine against the world being such a boring plastic fake place. So I kind of just tried to surround myself in interesting topics, but I did it more so personally. So I would sit at my computer and read about these things and dig out old newspapers and read up on crazy things that have happened in my neck of the woods here in Atlantic Canada, never really sharing what I was doing with other people aside from my close friends. Like, I've always had the reputation as being like an adventurer. Like, I'm always looking for something interesting to get involved in, and I'm a bit obsessive. So if I end up finding some interesting thing, I'll be, you know, really, or I say some interesting thing, but I really mean something that interests me, and I would just, you know, really get into it. But what ended up leading to me starting my show, the Nighttime Podcast, and putting what I was doing more out into the public via my show is a project, I'll say, that I was working on. The news ended up covering it, and it was wasn't like a big story, but it was a moderately big story in Nova Scotia at the time. What ended up happening was walking home from work, and it was just I think this is probably late May, just walking home. It just turned out that the battery in my cell phone was dead, so I couldn't listen to a podcast. And so I was kind of bored, and I saw some books on the side of the street, just kind of like half in the ditch, kind of on the side of the road. And I assumed that it was like some kids on their way home from school, like near the end of the school year. Maybe they threw away their scribblers or something. And I picked up the book that was closest to the sidewalk. It was just like a scribbler. And when I picked it up, my thought was, I'm going to read through this and just see, like, a kid in high school today, what, you know, what are they working on? So I picked it up, and I was happy to see it was like filled, like cover to cover, with cursive handwriting. And I noticed all the entries and all the pages were dated. So right away I was like, oh wow, this is like a, you know, like a journal or something. So as I'm walking, I'm reading this journal, and immediately I was really impressed with the quality of the writing. I noticed on the inside cover it said the name. It was like Eva Smith, grade 8. And as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, like, when I was in grade 8, I couldn't write anything like this. Like, the writing was really on point. It wasn't like Shakespearean, but it almost had this old-timey vibe to it. But as I was reading it, I thought still that this was a scribbler that somebody had thrown away from like a current student or whatever. And as I was reading it, impressed with what was written there, I kind of got lost in it, and I read it my whole way home. And when I got home, I showed it to my wife, and who's a teacher. I said, you know, look at how well written this grade 8 kid is. And my wife opened it up, and the first entry she opened it to was talking about the death of, it was like King George the 8th or something like that. And it was written as if like this king had died the day the person wrote this journal entry. And she's like, oh wow, like this must be really old. And I looked at it, and I'm like, well, I don't remember hearing about a king, let alone like a king dying. And that was what I then like pull out my phone, and I went on the computer or something and Googled, like, when did this king die? And I saw that it happened in like the 50s or something. So then we started, like, at that point, I'm like, whoa, maybe this is a really old journal, because it didn't look old at all. So then I flipped through a few more pages and found another entry that I was able to date. It was talking about Princess Elizabeth visiting this certain town. So I Googled when that happened and saw that that happened in the 50s as well. So it was at that point that I was like, holy shit, like, this is, you know, like a 60-year-old journal or something that looks, you know, like it was written in yesterday. It was, the pages were still white for the most part. So what I did was, for the next couple days, I just read it cover to cover a few times just to see what was in there and look for anything that could maybe explain why it was on the side of the road and why it was brand new looking. I couldn't find really anything. So what I did was I took a bunch of photos of the journal and I put them on Reddit and within a subreddit for my town of Halifax. And I was just saying, like, you know, look what I found. And I also had made it kind of my mission to figure out where the journal came from and why it was in pristine condition on the side of the road after 60 years. So I put that on Reddit and asking anyone who was interested to help me find the author and, you know, figure out the story. People started writing to me and giving me ideas on what to do and where to look. But eventually, a reporter from CBC News caught wind of it, and they ended up emailing me, and they wanted to do a story on it. So I was, like, on the news talking about the journal and where I found it and reading parts of it and stuff. And then I think about 2 days later, I won't get into the whole story because it's long, but eventually about 2 days later, we ended up getting a lead on who we thought the author may be. It was a really old lady. I think she was in her 80s. She thought it, or her cousin, I think, thought it was hers. So we called the lady, and what I was doing was she wasn't sure if it was hers. So what I did was I was reading entries of the journal, and it would say somebody's first and last name. And what I'd do is I'd read it and say the first name and see if she could tell me the last name. So I'd be like, you know, I was walking down the street with Pirate, and she'd say, Larry, I had a friend, Pirate Larry, just as an example. And so then as we're reading it, she's like, that is my journal. So the reporter came and got me, and we go to this lady's house, and I ended up giving her journal back, and it was like this nice TV moment. Mm-hmm. But the mystery was still there, where she had no idea how the journal – She told me she hadn't seen that journal since grade 8.
Yeah.
She has no idea why it was on the side of the road. She didn't like have it in her possession and lose it. So the mysteries as to why it was there is still unsolved. As far as why it looks brand new, that's crazy as well. I can only think it must have been like just jammed between other books, and the air wasn't even getting at it. Because again, the pages weren't even yellowed after almost 65 years.
Yeah. I've heard you actually make that comment. There was a couple in the lead up to things here. We like to do our homework if we can, but I know you've appeared on Grammarica and with the Jim Mallard Show, and as well as you've done up to 30 episodes now. But yeah, I've heard your remark on that particular in the past, and I think you might be onto something there. But and the way that it ended up on the side of the road, my only guess is somebody was just they found it. It's like, oh, this is trash, garbage. They loaded up their the back of the pickup, and we're headed to take it to the dump, and it just flew out for some reason. That's kind of what I kind of sort of pictured in my mind as a potential scenario.
That was kind of what I thought as well. It's just what's weird is the school that she went to when she wrote it was about an hour and a half drive from where I found it. It was in a whole different town. So like she later in life had moved from one town to the city that I live in. And so how it ended up in the city that I live in, the whole thing is bizarre. But anyway, really like with the attention, not that I got like lots of attention or anything, but just when that whole thing happened in the news, I started thinking like maybe people are interested in the types of things that I'm doing all the time. And that was really like my motivation to launch my show. And it's just been kind of – I've just been taking it week by week, doing an episode, usually every 2 weeks or so. Some I'll take breaks here and there, but – I guess that's really what got the whole thing started. I call it the nighttime podcast because I work on it in the nighttime. I have a family and a young son, so when everybody else goes to bed, I start plugging away at the computer.
And a lot of people, because it's a one-man show basically, is the sound of things, and a lot of people that have not ever taken the time to put podcasts together don't realize how demanding it really is, and it's a lot of work and a lot of hours. So
it's a pain in the ass is the way I put it. It's the editing and stuff, because I want it to sound good, and I don't do it live or anything. I take interviews and edit them, and I'm solo, I can't by solo I mean I don't have a co-host or anything. I can't conversate with someone else about it, so I kind of script it out. So I do a lot of writing and stuff as well. So I probably spend way more time than it's worth on it.
And we are running live now too, of course, streaming via YouTube. We have some folks that have filled up here in the comment section what we, to this point at least, are calling the front end of the Rogues Gallery. The after show, of course, is where we transition to the back end of the whole thing, the Rogues Gallery, and take it from there with the feature content and subscribership end of things. But and for people too that you mentioned CBC, a lot of Americans might not know that stands, of course, for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. That's a pretty great way to launch your career, obviously, in the field of radio journalism, really.
I suppose so, yeah. And I was, the CBC's been very good to me because they covered that when I released my first episode, which was shortly after that whole thing with the journal. They did a story on that. And then an episode of my show, one particular episode was covered pretty extensively by CBC on a national story. So I really got a boost halfway through due to their coverage.
Was that the young lady who disappeared, Philpott or something like that? I think was her name.
Emma Philpoff is her name. She's a missing person from Victoria, and I would think my show is probably most well known for at this point a 3-part series that I've done on her disappearance. Mm-hmm. The fourth part is actually coming out this Sunday, but it's through the 3 parts that I've released so far. Her mother and I have become close, so her mother is a guest on 2 of those episodes. And the main I say the main suspect, but what I really mean is the person who many people consider to be a suspect in her disappearance was the guest on the 3rd show. So it's some pretty heavy stuff.
Jeez. Oh, wow. And,
What ended up happening was I did the first episode on the case of the disappearance with Emma's mother as my guest. And shortly after the first episode, Emma's mother was, unrelated to her disappearance, was arrested and charged with something.
Yeah.
And shortly after that, she appeared on my show and addressed the charges for the first time publicly. So CBC made a big deal about that, because she's pretty well-known in Canada. Fortunately, the charges have since been dropped, and many of us have stood by her mother throughout the whole ordeal, knowing that she wasn't involved in the things she was accused of, and we're glad that the charges are dropped.
Are you willing or able to go into what – I mean, it is public record, I suppose, but are you able to lay that out for our listeners, what the charges were leveled and by whom?
Yeah, well, she was arrested on charges of drug trafficking and possession of illegal possession of firearms. I won't get into the details, but there was in her home there was drugs and illegal firearms found. So when Emma's mother is well known in Canada as an advocate for missing people, specifically her daughter. And there's been a well-known Canadian documentary filmed about Emma's disappearance that Emma's mother was involved in. So when that arrest happened, it was all over the news. It was a national story. So a lot of people were talking about it, a very big deal. But it turned out that police, I guess you'll say, or the prosecutors, they dropped the charges against Emma's mother, and Emma's brother is the one who is now will be on his way to trial soon for those charges.
And does this also happen to be the guest that you had on your 3rd episode, I believe is what you said, that is presently in the spotlight as potentially being the perpetrator of the crime?
Yeah, no, it's in these charges with Emma's family have nothing to do with her disappearance, completely unrelated. It's just the 2nd episode of the series. CBC had covered it just because the charges were brought up on my episode and it hadn't been spoken about publicly, so they made a big deal about it. The 3rd episode, which is the one that features the commonly considered suspect, his name is Julian. He's a guy that he was a kind of on again, off again friend of Emma's before her disappearance. Many people accused him of stalking her. And what ended up happening was when she did go missing, coincidentally, she went missing from a town that this guy had arrived at shortly before she disappeared. Some people feel that he may have showed up there intentionally to find her. And it also turned out that the day she disappeared, he saw her earlier in that morning, the day she disappeared. So there's a lot of coincidences that kind of, when you look at it, there's a lot of coincidences that you're like, that's just, you know, too strong of a coincidence. But having spoken to him on my show and hearing his side of his story, personally, I feel as though he's just another kind of victim in this whole tragic story. I think he was a guy that was infatuated with a girl, and in the middle of his pursuit of her, she ends up going missing, unrelated to anything he did. But he sure as hell, when you look at it, he sure as hell looks suspicious. But on my episode, he lays it out, the whole thing, as to how about his involvement with her, and he tells the whole story, and I felt like he was sincere, and I would be comfortable having him at my house for supper if he ever arrived in my hometown.
So that's a 3-part series. You have a fourth segment coming out shortly, from the sounds of things. Any listeners, mm-hmm. of course, that are interested in maybe looking into this a little further, we'll be able to add a link to the show notes easily enough. Once again, what I found most user-friendly, although I did notice sometimes the things that are right there in front of your face you just don't see. But, yeah, you've got direct links, download links as well, too, off of your website too. So that's another way of doing it as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nighttimepodcast.com. You can see all my episodes and download them all from there. And my show's on iTunes, so that makes it easy if you have a phone in your pocket.
And your presence on Facebook. Your YouTube, I guess, is transitioning. You don't we're not going to add that at the moment. People can expect, though, to look forward to that, and we'll hopefully keep people up to speed on that.
I never got into the YouTube thing. I see what you're doing here with the live stream on YouTube. This is awesome. I would love to set something like this up, but yeah. I have always done it the old fashioned way. Well, I guess not old fashioned. Maybe it's the modern way, but I just release them on iTunes, and then they end up on all those other things, like you said, Podbean or whatever. They end up all over the place, but mm-hmm. Website's home base. Sorry.
You said your website's your home base. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I'll put the episodes up there, and I have a blog where I occasionally will put stuff up there. But that's really anything I do, it's, you know, it'll end up on my website in most cases.
Yeah. Well, that's why we got you here today, because, you know, once again, just looking over the show content and topics that were being discussed. And I mean, how could anyone not help but be drawn in? It's you've got a really definitely a winning formula, and the way that you present things is very professional and easily, I guess you would say, accessible, consumable, and great stuff. So it's also interesting to note, too, I guess, offer congratulations. One of the notes that we have here is that after the release of episode 30, your show had surpassed the 1 million total download mark. So that's quite amazing.
Yeah, I was pumped about that.
How did that happen?
Well, it's a lot of work over the last year, really, and it's just slowly growing a listener base episode after episode, and keeping things interesting enough to have them, you know, tell a friend or whatever. So it just slowly grew it. I remember when I hit 1,000 downloads, I was just, you know, blown away that I had that many people listen. Then I hit 10,000, and then I hit 100,000, and I knew eventually I would hit 1 million. Like when I was seeing it pick up, I knew I would hit 1 million. And that's kind of the magic number for a lot of podcasts. It's like if you've gotten 1 million or more, like you kind of like made it. So it feels good. It's like it's so much work, and you get a lot of criticisms and haters and all that kind of stuff. But when you see a number like that, and there's that many people that – the MP3 I made on the computer in my basement ended up in their phones. That's just, I don't know. It's kind of cool. It makes me feel good. And it's just encourages me to continue to do it and try to improve and see if I can hit, you know, 2 million or 10 million or God knows how many.
Yeah. Just have to just keep an eye on things and see where it all leads to. So one of the things also we have noted here is that just with the slideshow we've got streaming, we compiled a number of the pictures that you had mostly on Facebook, but
yeah, there's me. I can see me as a little boy. I'm looking at one of the pictures that stream is of my Christmas. I think I was like 6. My parents gave me what went on to become the Chucky doll from Child's Play, and I see the picture come up every so often.
Right. So yeah, we just have it's just set on random there. So I suppose we could do a little better way than the way it is at the moment, but. I'm looking at this huge mic you've got here in your hand right now. So, Santa was pretty he was pretty generous with you this year, it looks like. But
that's a gift for my brother. I'm talking into it right now. I love it.
Awesome. Well, and what kind of mic is it exactly?
It's I don't know much about this stuff. It's called an RE20 Electro Voice. It's like a a big, huge thing. It looks like a weapon more than a microphone.
Well, you could look at it that way, too, I suppose, if you wanted. It's all a matter of perspective, I suppose. So, but the Star Wars, Carrie Fisher's passing, I'm just going to quickly just bounce that off you before we kind of really sink our teeth into the meat of what we're hoping will be our heart of our discussion here today. But, yeah, Carrie Fisher, just a comment or two on how that may be impacted you.
Yeah, I think the whole year was hard. And maybe you feel the same thing, but as I get older, my mortality becomes more and more obvious. And when I see those that I've looked up to pass away, like I've been a massive fan of Prince and a massive fan of David Bowie. When they both passed away, that was really heavy. And then Carrie Fisher passing away, just as I was kind of getting really excited for Star Wars, I had just rewatched the new series the original series because I was going to go see Rogue One at the theaters, and I had just finished the third part of the original series when I like looked at my phone and saw the news that she had passed away, and it's just another like icon from my childhood. I'm not into the royal family or whatever, so when I think of a princess, I'm thinking of Carrie Fisher, and I just feel like, you know, the only princess I've ever known in reality has passed. And again, to now know that I live in a world that Prince isn't being purple in and David Bowie's not being weird in, it just feels different as these, and George Michael, like I've never been a massive fan of his music, but he's an icon and he's not in the world anymore as a living being. And it's just, as you age and see these people that are just kind of a generation ahead of you passing away, it's a heavy feeling.
Major reality check.
Hell yeah.
The way I like to look at it is that we're just here, we're passing through. Leonard Cohen, RIP.
Exactly.
Another example of a lot of people's, you know, these musical heroes and icons, and for good reason too, of course, very talented. And just amazing the way that they could produce material that would move people so deeply. That was one of his a cover tune that he did years ago. So Valdi, actually, you might be familiar with, the West Coast folk musician living out there. I guess he's still out there on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia. He actually did a cover of that song as well off his Landscapes album. I'm throwing this all at you because I used to be a bit of an LP collector back in the day, but those are all. I'm based out of South Korea now, in case you weren't aware. But I ended up leaving a fair sized LP collection in storage out in Edmonton that ended up being rifled through and just essentially pilfered. So, but that's I'll chalk that all up to karma. Another quote from William S. Burroughs that I'm always reminded of, too, within the context of what we're discussing here, is we're all here to go. We are all here to go. Is that a little too heavy for you right now? Maybe so, but hang on. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. What happened is what changed a lot of my feelings about it was 4 years ago when I had my son. I have a child, and after he was born, it just, everything felt differently. Like the day before he was born, I wouldn't say I didn't care if I lived or if I died, but I never it wasn't like that, but I wasn't so worried about the future. If I passed away, you know, the world, life would go on, so be it. Now, once he was born, the stakes got so much higher because now I want to be healthy and I want to live forever to see, you know, it's heavy to think about, but seeing these great people before me pass away, I don't know. It just, I worry about it. I don't like to think about it. A part of me in my head, I think I still feel like I'm 17, but then sometimes I look in the mirror and I'm like, oh my God, I'm not at all 17 anymore.
Reminded me to ask you, and hopefully you don't mind commenting, but in the lead up once again to putting the show together, pre-production phase of things, came across a couple photos of your grandpa. He's 92 years young now, and I think he's still doing, he's hanging in there in the hospital, but apparently he gets a big kick out of listening to your podcasts whenever he can.
Oh yeah. He'll tell anyone who'll listen about it. And he's doing great. My granddad is, he's tough as an ox, but he's also been on death's door for the last 10 or 15 years. It'll be, you know, like once a year he'll get like a flu or a really bad cold, and it like it gets close and people are really worrying, and then he just bounces back, and he's tough as nails. But he loves my podcast. My first episode is about him and his UFO sighting in 1986 in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, Canada. He's very into the UFO phenomenon. So any episodes I do about UFOs, he loves. And he grew up in and around the Oak Island treasure hunt. He was good friends and grew up in the neighborhood with one of the early treasure hunters in the 40s and 50s. So he was involved in Oak Island since he was a little kid. So he's really into that. And we always, you know, I'm his favorite person to talk to because I'll talk UFOs in Oak Island with him. And that's all he really wants to talk about.
That's great. Hey, I'm this fellow that you refer to with regarding Oak Island, one of the old timers there. With that, and I'm not sure what better way to refer to him at the moment because his first name escapes me, but it's just Old Man Blankenship. He's the same age as your grandfather. Yeah. Is that the guy you're talking about?
Perhaps, no, or? it's before Blankenship. The guy my granddad knew was M.R. Chappell. He was one of the treasure hunters that was well before Dan Blankenship. There was M.R. Chappell was there in the chapels. I think probably started in the 30s and ended their search around the 50s. Blankenship, who you would see a lot on the TV show now, he would have taken over probably 15 years, 20 years after them.
And just for listeners who have not seen the reality-based TV show series, you can find the episodes up on YouTube for the most, I think, can't you? And the name exactly, if people aren't clear, it is...
It's called The Curse of Oak Island, and it's a History Channel production that's now in its fourth season. I don't know. It's probably on YouTube. You can stream them on the History Channel on their website. And if you have cable, it's like if you go to the History Channel, they do that thing where some days they'll play like, you know, 20 episodes in a row and they just like do a marathon or something. But it's one of the highest rated shows on cable in Canada and the States. It's popular all over the world. You mentioned you're in North Korea. I know the show is very big.
I wish I was in North Korea. It's ironically the marijuana policy there. There's no prohibition against it whatsoever. In the South, drowning in a sea of alcohol and pharmaceuticals. You better watch your step with that stuff. Who knows where it could lead? It's pretty heavy handed. It's just a totally bizarro world. So no, I live in South Korea.
It's okay. I'm an idiot when it comes to like anything outside of Canada. I don't know anything about the rest of the world. But I know about every UFO sighting in Canadian history. So,
I bet you don't. I'll share that with you maybe in the Rogues Gallery end of things. And it's a bit of a personal twist that I've actually blogged, and I'll share, you know, once again, I'd be happy to present that to you and just, leave it, in your hands, and you make of it what you will. Yeah. There's also a couple other stories that, including Wap May and the Mad Trapper of Rat River, Albert Johnson, that was, I thought, would be a great story for you to potentially at least take a look at. I'm sure your grandpa would get a big kick out of that. He probably remembers that, of course. Have you heard are you familiar with that whole saga? Oh boy, Samba Tom wrote a song about it. Would you check out
did
that?
He?
Yeah. Oh geez, yeah. I mean, if it was me and I was doing a show, I'd be cranking up the Stompin' Tom and you know, that's definitely got. And I don't care about the copyright. If you want to demonetize on YouTube, go ahead. That's not really an issue for us. We were more about the content and putting good quality, you know, shows together. So yeah, I'll talk to you more about that later, but. Let's see, you know, Pirate Larry, I've been meaning to actually just talk to you here and ask you, we're talking about all these people dying and whatnot. Of course, it's an inevitable part of the whole birth cycle of existence and so forth. But my question really for you, Pirate Larry, is when they die, where do pirates go? What happens to them?
Well, I'll tell you what my grandfather said to me. He said, son, I want you to look out there and tell me what you see. And I said, well, there's snow. And he says, okay. He says, now when the snow melts, where does the white go? I said, I don't know, Grandpa. He says, well, that's where I'm going.
Was your your grandpa was a pirate too, was he?
He was a Scotch Irish Indian or Scotch Indian.
Go ahead.
And then, you know, there's the ancient, which is that we all came from the stars and we're all going back to the stars, you know, and we'll come back again. I mean, you know, nobody ever dies, but there has to be death to teach people that life is precious. Otherwise we chop off each other's heads and use it as bowling balls, which I guess we've done.
Yeah. Well, if that's what we're to the extreme lengths that we are pressed, then it leaves little other choice, I suppose, than to defend ourselves using whatever means necessary. You know, I prefer to neutralize any adversary first and foremost because of the karma that, you know, that you find yourself caught up in with there. But I think, yeah, what you're getting at there is a lot of space, just openness and space, really, with the mountains and the whiteness and the open air and the snow. But just quickly before we jump back there to Jordan, how about what Davy Jones' locker? There's got to be some pirates spending a fair deal of time down there too, I'd imagine.
Yeah, there's all my friends in Davy Jones' locker, you know, but they're still in their stars. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a memory. It's like a memory that connects you. You know. If you're in a dream and you can actually feel the furniture and it, you remember the, you know, how it feels, and you can kind of see the sweat on the brick walls or whatever, it's an existential memory. You know, if it's a dream and you're flying around and blah, 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 it's a dream. You know, if it's a dream and you're arguing with your cousin over some bill, you know, I don't know, that's something else, but you know, when you have those lucid dreams where you can actually touch things, you know, and stuff, these are existential memories that are built in the DNA. We don't remember. We come in the Earth world and we don't remember, but the DNA remembers and the stars remember, and the light in each other can remember each other if we only give it a chance.
Well, dreams, that's another topic, of course, and a great one too. You could have a whole show just dedicated to dreams. So maybe we could save that for the back end of today's presentation at the Rogues Gallery, end of things. And if I know it's getting late out there, you're half an hour ahead of Montreal, Toronto, New York, all those places. Aren't you out in the Maritimes there, Jordan?
No, we're a full hour ahead in Atlantic time. You're probably thinking of Newfoundland time, which is a half hour off. But I'm an hour ahead, so it's where I'm at right now. It's 12:45 in Toronto, be 11.
Jeez, are you kind of a night owl yourself? Then it's from the sounds of it, with your podcast, it is the night. How late do you take it into the night? I know I was up till about 4 o'clock this morning trying to get all of our ducks in a row here, so things set up.
What? Roll. Yeah. Man. I used to be a crazy night owl and I could stay up all night. Now, with a day job and with a son who keeps me up pretty early, I usually like one or two nights a week, I'll stay up late, but there's nights where I'm going to bed at 9:30 and then nights where I'm going to bed at 3:30. But I'm not like I wouldn't consider myself a night owl, but I can hold my own in the nighttime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I found just because as with yourself, this whole podcasting business is very, very, we're coming up to marking our first year anniversary. And that, by the way, Pirate Larry did not draw to your attention, but we're going to be scheduling that for the 50th episode. So got a lot of good stuff coming there, hopefully with a lot of just reflection and to talk about what we have maybe in store for us in the future. But once again, it was about a year ago that I got all kind of rooked into this whole thing of finally going for it, and almost as if I was drawn, believe it or not. It's, I know it sounds strange, but it was like, you know, because even back in my, when I was a teenager, there's people pushing me, wanting to, you know, to get me into radio. So I guess this is where I've ended up at the moment, and we're just going to have to try to make the most of it. But the night owl thing, big time. I've never found more people that like to stay up, you know, through the witching hour and what have you, then, since it became more heavily involved online, Facebook and so forth, different multimedia outlets and whatnot. But let's get in. So what greater date, once again, than Friday the 13th, January, Friday the 13th, 2017. Last night I was doing the calculation in my head thinking, oh my God, this is 700 years to the date with, you know, the arrest of the Templars, but not quite. I think I got it down at 710 years to the date. With the whole business of Jacques de Molay. And if I got my story straight here, I didn't do enough homework on this front, but he was the Grand Sovereign Commander of the Knights Templar and was arrested by Philip, then King of France, Philip the Fair. A lot of people don't know as well, too. That's really why a lot of the superstition business, apparently, with Friday the 13th, exists in our culture. It partly goes back to that, as well as some people talk about even tying into the whole business of the Last Supper, Jesus and the 12 disciples. So, but if you could just take it from there with, you know, what occurred at that day in 1307 with Jacques de Molay and how this all kind of maybe leads into the things like the missing Templar fleet, Roslyn Chapel, and even Oak Island, there's been so much speculation.
Yeah, it's one of many theories on Oak Island, and oddly for me, I enjoy all the theories. The Knights Templar theory, I haven't found, or no one has presented to me conclusive anything that puts that theory ahead of any of the others. Although it is one of the ones that gets the most discussion, especially now that the TV show, The Curse of Oak Island, that seems to be one of the theories that they favor on the show. So there's a lot of talk about it. I don't know a lot of the history of the Knights Templar. I know that Friday the 13th was the day that a lot of them were executed. At the time that the Templar broke up and a lot were executed and arrested and all that, they had a lot of wealth and a lot of quote unquote treasures, that they had to get rid of. And so a lot of research has been done into what they did with the various treasure they had, like the Holy Grail and the Ark of the Covenant and all the, you know, the fleet of ships and whatnot. I've seen several different, and by several, I probably have seen 100 different theories on where they ended up. And it seems like the Templar, as well as Oak Island, it's one of those things from history. It's like a puzzle piece that you can kind of fit into any mystery. So a lot of different mysteries will have a Knights Templar theory associated with them. Oak Island certainly does. And it's one of those things where it's just like, again, if you look at something like Oak Island as a big puzzle to put together, Knights Templar is kind of like, you know, a circle puzzle piece, and it'll kind of fit anywhere on the map. So much of the history is vague and inconclusive and, you know, not one way or another confirmed. Mm-hmm. So it makes it a very kind of vague but also kind of a romantic theory or idea that you can add into it. But one of the theories of Oak Island is that the Knights Templar ended up there, that a fleet of them showed up buried or somehow got the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant, and all the various gold and precious artifacts of religious significance. Some people believe that that's what's sitting at the bottom of Oak Island. And people have various reasons to believe that that is the case. People look at a lot of old maps, or they're trying to even read between the lines in Shakespearean first edition Shakespeare books. Some people are looking for clues within the writing, such as oddly placed capital letters and odd spelling mistakes and odd spacings. Some people believe that there are secrets in the first edition of Shakespeare's books that leave hints that the Knights Templar was involved in Oak Island.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's something that I believe it's known as the Knights of the Helm. This kind of ties in somewhat to the movie that came out a couple of years ago called Anonymous that depicted, if memory serves, something along the lines of Shakespeare just being sort of a front man, basically, a persona Trematis, if that's the correct, Latin. But just somebody, he was a simple sort of, was it a stagehand or stable boy, highly uneducated. They had this group called the Knights of the Helm, I think is what they're known. They were like a literary group. And they would collaborate and work together and doing, as you say, producing the works of Shakespeare. Some people have suggested it was Francis Bacon on his own. Mm-hmm. Others, Edward de Vere, was it the third Earl of Oxford or something to that extent. So, yeah, who really knows? But it's interesting where we could go with all this because literally all over the map, which is kind of, that's, you know, pirates are comfortable with that. Not a problem. But FDR, two names that jump out, and we can bop around a little bit through history here because I know like there's books like Holy Blood and the Holy Grail came out back in the mid 1980s, which you've probably read and you're aware that was the largely like a primary influence to behind Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. But things like the Cathars and the Albigensian Crusade, as you say, like the Holy Grail and even the bloodline of Christ. That's quite something too, of course. And Roslyn Chapel, and I think the founder, in fact, of the Knights Templars, or one of them that was entrusted with the Templar fleet, was, and he did had a leading hand in putting together the Roslyn Temples, Henry Sinclair. I'm not sure, does that name mean much to you at all?
Oh, yeah. Henry Sinclair is also involved in a lot of the theories related to Oak Island and even just around Atlantic Canada. There's a lot of other sites that have a mystery associated with them that people trace back to the Templar or Sinclair. But again, it's always my problem with so many of those theories is they're always so vague. And when people present them, it just seems like they're just kind of grasping at straws to put things together to include the Templar or Henry Sinclair, because it's kind of it can be seen as a romantic thing because the history is so interesting and mysterious. So I think a lot of people who are researching a particular mystery, I think some people are motivated to try to find a link to the Templar.
Mm-hmm. How much of that do you think just generally, just, you know, straight across the board, do you think is intentional though as well too, with people who, like, with say like any mystery or conspiracy, they are purposely engaged in working to muddy the waters?
I don't know in terms of percentage, but there's definitely a lot of it, because a lot of people are researching a story. They want to get, they're motivated for some reason to have their research and the story spread further. Maybe they're going to write a book or film a documentary or do whatever. So when you're researching a story, there's a little bit of storytelling and artistry that kind of comes into play. Because if not, it will just end up as a boring research paper or something. So right. A lot of the research that you hear about online and cool blogs getting shared around and stuff, there's some intriguing spin put on it. Like, for example, if I was – I won't use Oak Island because Oak Island's always so interesting anyway. But if there's, you know, some well that I find in the middle of the woods near my house, I could just do a straight archaeological survey of it and release a scientific paper that goes nowhere and nobody cares about it, even if it is interesting and intriguing. But if it's, you know, if it's just scientific and that's it, there's – not much going to happen. But if I can find, some way to relate it to the Templar or some way to relate it to this bizarre UFO sighting or, you know, whatever the case may be, and can spin it in a creative way and build a narrative around this mysterious place being connected to this incredible history, all of a sudden the newspaper is going to want to talk to me, and it's going to, you know, going to be shared all over Twitter and Facebook and all this stuff. So there's motivation there to find a link between blank and insert significant historical figure here.
Always just constantly looking for some way to sex things up. So,
yeah.
And that kind of leads back to what occurred. I'm not sure how long ago exactly, but there was a sword that was discovered, very controversial. And I think you know a lot about that. It was said to be of Roman era, and someone came across it just off in the shallow waters, just off the shore of Oak Island, and one thing led to another. It became a whole kind of
We call it Swordgate. And you may see it in the I have a photo of holding the sword on my Facebook. You may see it in your slideshow here.
It's there. We got it.
Yeah, not the sword that you would have seen on the show, but it's believed to be cast from the same mold. But yeah, that the story of the sword is something I plan to cover on my show in the not too distant future. But it's the story is ridiculous, and it makes Oak Island and the various theorists that study it look bad. But it was basically a sword was said to be found in the waters near Oak Island. The sword was then presented to people involved in the production of the TV show. The people involved in the TV show were interested and decided that they would have the sword tested to see, you know, how old is it and is it possibly related to what's going on in Oak Island. So that was about as far as it went. But some of the people behind the sword and bringing it to the production team, they really spun it online and put together what looked like legit news articles but were really kind of just glorified blog posts that basically went as far as to say that this sword is going to rewrite history and change everything about, you know, what people thought of the Romans and Atlantic Canada and Oak Island and all this other stuff. It was a romantic story, and the news caught wind of it, and all of a sudden it was all over the place. Everybody, like if all over Atlantic Canada and all over Canada, there was even stories in like CBC and stuff about this sword being found and rewriting history. A lot of people tuned into the TV show to see the sword, and that was really about it. But what ended up happening was the next week on the TV show, they tested the sword, and I think they said it was like 70 years old or something, and it's not Roman and it's not old. It's like a tourist kind of souvenir from like the 50s or 40s or something like that. And that, since it was all in the news like a week or so prior, and it turned out to be a fake, the news then covered it again and kind of made it seem like the people behind the TV show had tried to fake the sword's age and relevance with the treasure. But that's not at all what happened. It really was the entire Swordgate thing was really the work of one or two people who were doing it in promoting the sword's importance as a way to kind of self-promote their own blogs and research. And it really, in the end, what it ended up happening was it made Oak Island look bad to the average person, and it made the people that were actually behind it look really, really bad, but only to the people who were kind of in the know as to what happened. But it's a kind of a complicated story that involves a lot of people. But that sword has nothing to do with Oak Island, and it's not old. The one we had that you may see a photo of me with in the slideshow here, that was tested by the same university professor who tested the sword from the Oak Island TV show and said it's the same age old and probably cast from the same mold. The sword, it looks really old, but it's like kind of painted and stuff to make it look that way. It has like some material over it that's designed to kind of look like this rusty old sword. But anyway, the whole thing is fake and bogus and a bunch of BS.
How did that go over in the public's in the eyes of the public? Was there a backlash following that episode?
Oh yeah, definitely. People, the average person, what else has happened is there was backlash, and people started accusing the TV show of planting things to make it look like they're making discoveries and stuff. Right. When that's really not what happened. It's the show comes out once a week. So on one episode, they are presented with the sword and they talk about what the sword could mean if it is as old as the people presenting it are saying it is. Then it's a week later until the next episode of the show runs, but it was all over the news all that week saying, like, you know, this is going to change everything. And people were reading those articles thinking it was like kind of the people behind the show saying all this stuff, but it wasn't.
Right.
Then when they actually tested it and it didn't mean anything, it just it all kind of blended together. People didn't know who was saying what, and it ended up making the show kind of look fake. And it also ended up leaving a lot of misinformation to people who aren't deep into the Oak Island story. A lot of people, if I just went to the mall by my house and said, you know, what do you know about Oak Island to a random person? They may very well say, well, there was a sword found there last year. That may be all they know. But not true.
And so was it ever discovered then? I'm not sure if you really precisely hit on it or not, but who were the perpetrators then of this apparent hoax?
Oh, it's I wouldn't even say the name to fear it coming across as promotion. Uh-huh. But it was somebody. It was somebody who appeared on a early season of the show, and now is just kind of like a bitter ex-girlfriend that's kind of following the show around via various blog posts and tweets and all this stuff. But there's Oak Island, more than anything else that I've ever experienced, it has a lot of hangers-on and people who are trying to get involved, mainly due to the popularity of the TV show. The TV show is, as I said, it's one of the most popular shows in Canada, and it's watched all over the world. So a lot of people, I think, I don't know, they're just trying to get involved in it. And the people behind the sword, they had got a little bit of the spotlight because they were on an episode or two of the show. And I think this was kind of like maybe their way of getting back on the show. And it just backfired and made a lot of people look silly.
Exactly. So let's see if we can get Pirate Larry back on here from the crow's nest. How are things looking to this point from where you see things up there, Larry?
Well, sword stealing or, you know, circus sword swapping. It's kind of, I guess people will do anything for promotion these days. But, you know, with the internet, everything seems to backfire real quick. Karma happens faster with the internet than I think it ever did before. So it's, it's interesting to see, hoax news versus people that are doing some real research out there and trying to, you know, find the story.
What I was going to ask you about in particular, in addition to your comments regarding that matter, is this whole business of the Knights Templar. I'm sure you know a thing or two about the history yourself, do you not? And their purported involvement in Oak Island, if not simply just this whole business of the missing Templar fleet.
Well, yeah, where did they go? I mean, did they run off to the New World and scatter? These were people who were, I guess, you know, they came from the Crusades. They came back with, you know, whatever wisdom treasures they could haul. They were, you know, like mercenary soldiers like everybody else. But as far as I can, you know, understand, the people would give their land and property to God. They would give it to the church. So the church was like growing all over Italy. And there was a man named Garibaldi, who is highly revered in Italy, that took all the land back from the church and made it Italy. And put the church in the Vatican, which was a separate state. To me, it's like, you know, what treasures? The treasures are the words that were said. Treasures are the meaning in life that people get. You want gold chalices? I mean, I don't know. Did Jesus ever see a gold chalice? I have no idea. But I kind of doubt it. That's not, you know, the reputation of who he hung with. So, treasure's getting lost in the ocean. You have people that are, you know, fleeing religious oppression in Europe. I'm sure, you know, a lot of that happened. And tables were turned, different marriages. You know, to me, the whole thing of bloodlines is ridiculous because didn't Jesus say, you know, this is my body, this is my blood, and it will be given to you, you know? Well, so, I mean, everybody has, you know, the bloodline of Christ, you know, unless you're thinking about Mary Magdalene and a parent, you know, a daughter or a son that was shipped away after the crucifixion, which so, is, you know.
Yeah, ridiculous. You may say ridiculous, but yeah, I'm sure you're also able to appreciate and acknowledge that some people do take the whole business of bloodlines and intermarriage quite seriously. In fact, I think we might have, we haven't heard from him in a while, but we've got one, just, we're going to have to check on this. We're not sure if he's available or not. Last we heard, he was in the Howling Wolf Inn. So we'll just, we're checking up on him. Right at the moment. Stand by, please. Stand by. Captain Sinclair, can you get him? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We got the captain coming. Hang on.
Ah, that's the captain, Long John Sinclair. Welcome aboard there, Jordan. Jordan Bonaparte, what better man to have on board the Robin Hood? In fact, did he pass? I think just with the name itself, he's able to come on the Robin Hood. Isn't that right, Pirate Larry? I think we lost Pirate Larry. Anyways, yes, Captain Long John Sinclair here. So, thank you once again, Jordan, for being a part of things today. And as far as the missing Templar fleet is concerned, I do have a few insights and answers that I'm able to provide along those lines. But of course, those are all highly secretive, and nobody will ever hear much of anything as far as the concrete end of it all is concerned.
We don't want to get you in trouble.
And speaking of bloodlines, yes, the Sinclair bloodline, one very important need to pay attention to. In fact, if you look at the world of politics now in Canada, there is a Sinclair, in fact, who just so happens, coincidentally enough, to be sitting in a seat as the head of state and prime minister. Were you aware of that?
No.
Well, I'll turn things back over to Java, then I'm back for some rose and some oranges there, the Hallador at the end here. So, happy sailing, Jordan. Thank you once again.
Is he gone?
Yeah.
All right. Well, there he goes. Yeah, he tunes in. He listens to most of our shows there and just jumps in once in a while. The captain there, Captain Long John Sinclair. So
it's like pirate radio on. It's like pirate radio on pirate radio. He just takes over the feed.
Well, yeah, he hacks in, or I don't know how he's got his men that he's got working with him there. So, but yeah, my whole thing was this whole. It all goes back to this, you know, Shanghai last year, and along with another fellow, and we were both set up to be. They were priming us to be on board as powder monkeys. That was the idea. I'm not sure if you know what a powder monkey is, but I bet you know a few things regarding the maritime culture and histories, especially as far as shipping and trade and those sort of things are concerned. But here's one thing just to add to the whole business. I was hoping that maybe Pirate Larry would have hit on it, but that someone has mentioned this in the past, that it is rather coincidental to note, or very of import, or just, you know, something that seems somewhat significant, that with the disappearance of the Templars, from out of there came the rise of piracy on the high seas in a way that I don't think had ever been seen before, you know, especially from, like, the European standpoint, and their role and impact, and just the relations that they established, and ties with the so-called New World, you know, North America and Caribbean and so on, of course. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, I don't know a lot of the history of it all, but in a passive way, yes, I was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and how about that, too? I wasn't aware of that until I was listening to what he was going on about there. And apparently, what he's trying to say is that somehow Justin Trudeau is of the Sinclair bloodline. Do you know how that works exactly?
No, I've, I think I've seen a meme that explained it, and I just kind of scrolled past it.
I think that might have had to do with the Castro connection. Maybe you saw it as recently, some people saying that Pierre was not the father. But no, this is apparently someone just, they shot me a message here to kind of just fill me in and enlighten me on the matter. But his mother, Margaret Tudor, her maiden name, Sinclair. And her father is like some kind of high powered lawyer based out of Vancouver. And one of the kind of the things that just kind of drove him crazy was how Pierre chose that daughter of his to marry rather than the other one who was not near half as crazy, you know, cause we all know, like the whole world knows about how, you know, she's struggled with her bipolar issues and drinking and drugging to the point where it's, you know, people do this and they lose control, of course. And that whole business of her, famously partying with the Rolling Stones for however long and Club 54, or however the story goes. But yeah, just speaking of bloodlines, there you go. That's something I think is well worth looking into. I'd like to know more about it and find out whatever I could as far as, because I think there's a direct lineage there from William Sinclair of the supposed founder of Roslyn Chapel, just outside of Edinburgh, Scotland, and straight up to the current Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau.
Direct. Be interesting to see, yeah. Especially if someone could find that link. Like, if you went through the genealogy, and you know, without doubt, were able to put that together, that'd be pretty powerful.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's okay. I'll put that out there as a hypothesis, and you know that's how science works, of course, too, right? So it's testable. It's testable. As you say, and so people, whoever you are, I mean, I guess I could do it. You could, anyone could do it. They just have to put the time and effort and poking and looking around and digging a little deeper, I guess. So, and prove that hypothesis false if they're able to, or that no, he's on the mark with that one. So, yeah, definitely. That's quite a, it's a fascinating sort of talking point. So Errol Flynn, though, there's another name that jumps out at people, as well as FDR, who was apparently now Errol Flynn was said to have been some kind of spy master, Hollywood, you know, double agent of some kind, working with the Nazis on the sly, according to some accounts. But FDR, of course, well-known high-ranking Freemason, of which I think it's in the part, either the Red or Blue Lodges of Freemasonry, that maybe the Scottish Rite, that you get up to the, 18th degree or something like that, and you become an honorary Knights Templar. Have you ever heard of how that all kind of breaks down?
I have friends who are kind of like the experts in, especially in Freemasonry. I have a friend who's a Freemason, very, very into it. And he's always assisted me in anything relating to research that goes in that direction. I don't know enough about it myself to be able to speak confidently on it.
That's okay. So how about Errol Flynn or FDR? I know you'll probably be able to say a little bit about those two characters.
Well, FDR is linked to Oak Island. He was photographed there and was an investor there at one point. I don't know if Errol Flynn was involved in the island himself.
That's what has come up in my research, so I guess we'd have to look into that a little more.
Let me see. And a lot of them were a lot of the well-known guys like FDR. I believe even John Wayne was an investor. Actually, now that I'm looking at it, Errol Flynn, I'm just kind of Googling as we're talking here. He was linked to the island. I'm guessing, I don't know if he was actually there. FDR, a different story. He was actually there. Like, you can see the photos of him, you know, sure, standing with a group of guys with shovels. There's also in the Oak Island Museum, there's like a museum on the island itself. There's a lot of letters there that were sent back and forth to FDR where he wanted to stay up to date with what was going on the island. So there's the letters going back and forth that were keeping him up to date with the day by day of the dig. So that's a really cool history. One thing for anyone who ever visits Atlantic Canada, to visit the Oak Island Museum is a very cool place.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the questions we had for you, because once again, in the lead up to doing the show today, the research and end of it all, we had no idea that there was a museum. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about what people can expect if they do pay a visit?
Yeah, well, they do tours of the island every summer. If you can pay a couple bucks and take a walk around and see all the sights and whatnot. But basically, the way it works is as soon as you show up on the island, you pass a causeway that was built back in the 60s, and it was built specifically for bringing things on the island relating to the treasure hunt. But when you pass the causeway, as soon as you arrive on the island, there's two buildings. One is a museum, and one is, they call it the War Room. It's kind of like the main spot that you see in the TV show Curse of Oak Island. It's where a lot of that they kind of treat it like their office or home base sort of thing. But the museum is, it's like a museum / canteen. So when you walk in there, it's just probably about a 1200 square foot building. When you walk in, on one side, there's like some touristy stuff, like you can buy t-shirts and bottles of water and stuff. But the majority of the building is the museum, and all the walls are lined with old photographs of digging and newspaper articles and all that. But then the coolest part is when you're in the museum, there's all these kind of like tables with glass over them or whatever. And what they have inside is various things that were found on the island. So you see like the little piece of whatever, and it'll have a little piece of paper next to it that'll tell you where it was found, when, and how deep underground it was found. Some of the stuff is quite compelling. One in particular is a chain, or it's a link of a chain. So it's just like a little circle piece of metal. I think it was, I'm going off the top of my head, but I think they found it in the 70s, like 190 feet underground or something. And just the idea that there's a piece of chain 190 feet underground, that's very deep. And to me, that absolutely tells me that, and I guess not 100%, but it definitely looks to me as if it's it was by man's hand that chain ended that deep underground. I suppose there could have been a sinkhole or something, and that could have naturally happened, but there's all sorts of things that they found deep underground like that.
Absolutely. So, and just to back things up, because we haven't really made this clear for people who may not be up to speed on the whole Oak Island story, but I know you do a really great job in just giving a kind of overview, kind of historical summary, and how it's 217 some years ago that some young teenagers basically came across some anomaly, and the whole story kind of unfolded from there, digging and so forth at various stages, but that all the way down to this whole business of like booby traps supposedly, and how even today now the island has been apparently radically changed, so you can't even really recognize how it was that it actually used to be back in its original, more pristine state. There's only said to be, and then the curse too, but those are just the quick talking points I'd like to hit on here as we kind of take this one home here. Today's episode 45 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. With our feature guest Jordan Bone Party. So yeah, if you could just, how was this all discovered back some 200 plus years ago? What happened?
Yeah, and there's quite a few versions of the story, and the one I'll talk about is kind of the most widely shared version, although it is disputed almost every aspect of it. But basically, Oak Island, it's a small island among many other islands in what's called Mahone Bay in Nova Scotia. So there's an area called the Mahone Bay. There's a whole bunch of little islands. Oak Island is one of them. It's a very small island. It's, I think, 140 acres, so it's not very big. You could, in an afternoon, walk all the way around it twice, probably. But anyway, the whole story starts 222 years ago now. Basically, the most widely known story, or widely shared story, as I said, is a teenager was on a boat in the water in the Mahone Bay, and he saw some odd lights on a small uninhabited island. He, at the time, this was in the time of Prohibition when liquor was illegal, there was a lot of rum running and smuggling, and people were often using these small islands to stash illegal things like liquor or whatever. So he noticed the lights in this area and he thought, huh, that's probably people hiding something of value. Maybe I'll go pick it up tomorrow and have it, you know, for my own. So anyway, the next day he goes to where he saw the lights, and what he finds is a large oak tree, and underneath the oak tree, kind of a depression in the ground. It wasn't all dug up, as they say. It was just grassed over, but there was kind of a depression in the ground. So what he did was, with his shovel, he started digging. I think he got like a foot down and found a layer of flagstones, so flat stones, kind of like forming a bed under a thin layer of dirt. He expected to find treasure underneath it, pulled them up, and continued to dig. So I'll speed the story up now, because basically what ended up happening was he ended up getting friends involved, and when they dug deeper than they could handle, they got investors involved, and over the period of, I think, about 3 years, they managed to dig down pretty far. But what they were finding was every 10 feet, almost to the inch, they were finding a layer of stacked or horizontally laid logs. So they dig down 10 feet, find a layer of logs. They'd pull all the logs up, and they dig down 10 feet, another layer of logs, and they continue to dig down. But what was happening, or what ended up happening, was when they got to 90 feet down, things were really getting weird, because they weren't just finding the logs, but the logs, they were finding the logs being packed with clay. So there'd be digging through the dirt, then they would hit thick clay. The logs were kind of within the clay. And they were really getting down around 90 feet. That not only were they finding clay around the logs, but they was also finding thick layers of coconut fibers, the coconut trees don't exist in Nova Scotia. You know, so as they're digging, they're thinking, you know, this is definitely man-made. And every time they pull up the logs, they figure they're just about to find the treasure. But where things really got weird is at the 90-foot level, they found a large stone that appeared to have a carving on it. They brought that to the surface. And there was a layer of logs underneath that stone. So it was basically a large stone, which has come to be known as the 90-foot stone, sitting on this large on another layer of logs. It was dusk. The sun was just was setting, and they were very far down. They realized they were going to have to suspend the dig until the next morning, but they were pretty confident that the treasure was just below these logs. So the story is, with a large iron spear, he stuffed it between the logs and pushed it down into the dirt below the logs and hit something solid, like a treasure chest or something of that nature. And then said, we're going to have to deal with this tomorrow. It's getting too dark. So they left for the night. When they came back the next morning, up until this point, their pit that they've been digging has been dry. But when they come back the next morning, it's filled almost to the top with seawater. And that kind of sets off the next 180-ish years. Everybody after them have been trying to get down to that same level that they got to. But for whatever reason now, the water is the seawater is flooding the pit. Some people believe that when he pulled the stone up or stuffed the iron spear down, he may have set off a booby trap that let water in. Some people believe the clay that was surrounding the logs was put there to trap the water in specific areas. But what they have been doing to try to stop the water to get into the pit is they kind of went in the fields and whatnot that surround the area that they were digging, and they were digging down looking for how the water was entering. And what they ended up finding was a series of drains that run from the area of this pit under the island out to the sea. So people believe that the entire island was almost an engineering project that was built on top of a treasure with various booby traps that were designed to keep the areas where the treasure is flooded and to keep people from being able to pull it out of the ground. So this has been over 222 years. Various people have been trying with a variety of means to dig. They've been either dying. Six people have died so far in the search. So either there's been tragedies that have stopped digs. There's also been a laundry list of companies that were formed, got investors, and eventually ran out of money and had to suspend the dig. And basically you can trace the history. A good way to do it is even if you just go on like the Wikipedia site for Oak Island, there's a pretty basic timeline there. But when you get up to present day, what's happening now is the two treasure hunters are two guys from the United States, and as a way to fund their treasure hunt, they got the History Channel involved, and the History Channel's filming the TV show, The Curse of Oak Island, which is basically a reality show about these two brothers from the United States doing their treasure hunt on Oak Island.
Yeah, that booby trap. That's really quite something. So it almost looks like whoever dug the hole and set up the way that they did, it clearly seemed to have had known what they're doing, had some sort of expertise. I'm not sure, hydraulic or some kind of technology ability.
And just the size of the operation is what's so puzzling. If what people say is there is actually there, it would have taken an army, to dig up the whole island and build these drains under it, as well as to just dig a hole. At present day, people have found evidence of human activity, again, about 190 feet below the ground. So to dig a hole that deep back in the 1700s is when they expected this to happen. That would have taken a lot of work, even with today's cutting edge technology. They're having a hard time getting down there, but you can't put it past humanity, because I don't know if humans could build the pyramids today, but they built them way back then.
What depth, once again, was the booby trap located?
This one was 90 foot, at the 90 foot level.
Okay, that's where I'm a little confused, because I think, and I'm not sure of his first name, the old man Blankenship, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
His first name is?
Is Dan Blankenship.
Okay, Mr. Blankenship, Dan Blankenship. Apparently what he did, from what I heard, when you were discussing the matter with his son, that his dad went down to a depth, I could have swore he said like 230. I'm sorry?
Yeah, well, it was what ended up happening was I'll fill in the blanks here. So that what I had been talking about was the original money pit, and this was the original, like that hole where every 10 feet they were finding logs, and at 90 feet set off the booby traps. This was the original spot that people were digging looking for treasure. They call it the money pit, and this is where that guy found the depression in the ground under the oak tree. But what ended up happening was, one guy in, I think, the 40s, 50s, 60s, that era, his last name is Dunfield. When he took over the treasure hunt, he basically brought in really heavy machinery, and he's the one who actually built the causeway to the island. And he basically just bulldozed and dug up the whole thing. He didn't find anything, and he ran out of money, and he left. But after he left, nobody even knew, like the island was forever changed because it was so destructive, his work. So they don't even know nowadays where the original money pit was. So when old man Dunfield, as you so eloquently call him, when he took over the search after Dunfield.
Blankenship, you just kind of got to.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's okay. You got to flip around there. It's okay. Yeah.
It's late. Old man Blankenship. when he took over, he started looking in other parts of the island for spots of interest to do his own search. What he's most famous for is what's called 10X, and that's just the name of the hole that he dug. And his hole is much deeper. He dug 180 feet down to where he hit bedrock, like the rock below the ground. And then he dug with a massive drill, dug through the bedrock and found a void beneath it, which is at, I think, like off the top of my head, I think it's about 230 feet down. What ended up happening, and this is all discussed on an episode of my show, because I had Dan Blankenship's son, David, who is one of the stars of the show, but also helped him do a lot of the work. David was on my show and told this whole story. But basically what ended up happening was, when they dug this 180-foot hole in the ground, it started to collapse in on his dad, Dan Blankenship. Nobody was hurt. Dan Blankenship was pulled out of there by his son. But what they ended up doing to reinforce it is they bought old train cars that were no longer in service. They were for it would be to like carry oil on a train, like big kind of tanker things. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they basically buried them one on top of the other, and they used that as the structure of their hole that they were digging. So they used the abandoned railway cars to support their hole that they managed to dig down that deep. And that formed 10X, this hole, made up a big part of the TV show. The second and third season of the show, a lot of what they did takes place in and around that area.
So, and he barely, Blankenship barely escaped with his life, apparently, too. And did he not make the comment that he said when his son pulled him up that it was lucky that it was you were up here and not me at the helm at the watch, because otherwise you probably wouldn't have made it back up. His son acted
exactly.
Quickly. It was lucky.
Yeah, it saved his life. So they say his son pulled him up in record time and no one was hurt. I think the words he said when Dan Blankenship was pulled out of the hole by his son as he laid in the on the dirt next to it, probably out of breath, he said to his son, "Don't tell your mother about this."
And what's the first thing that Dad did when he got home?
Yeah, he told his mom.
He told that must his have wife. Been,
that, that, like, yeah, that must that must have been quite a conversation.
Yeah, such a bit of change of heart on the drive home, I guess. So, all right. Well, we're gonna basically this is kind of ratcheting things down here and steering things back into the harbor with the ship here that we call the Robin Hood. So just quickly, though, the last a number of just quick things before we take her to dock is regarding the curse, that it said that until the last oak is the treasure will not be found until the last oak is cut or seven people die. Right now there's apparently just one oak left on the island and six people have died. Is that right?
Well, that's what they say, but that's not true. There's the island's full of oak trees. There's been six people confirmed to have died on the island, but there's rumors that there were more of them back in history. So the whole curse is of questionable origin, and I don't know how much stock people put into it. It seems like the TV show kind of played up on the curse a bit at the beginning, but they kind of moved away from it, it seems. But I've been on the island multiple times, and there's oak trees all over the place. But they say six have died, and six have confirmed to be dead. And the curse says once seven have died, the island will unveil its secrets. So hopefully we never find out, because hopefully there's not a tragedy. But if there is a secret there, hopefully people just dig it up. Nobody has to get hurt, and no more trees have to get cut down.
Just imagine what could be found. It's bound to be something quite significant, you would imagine. So, but you've got a new project on the go here as well. Apparently, it's called Tales from the Graveside. Is that right?
Nope. I don't know what that could be.
Oh my! Well, I was once again on Facebook. There seemed to be a link that I'd followed from your from the Nighttime Podcast page to that. So maybe I'll share that with you later and just see what's
going on
there. Exactly.
Could even have been something a friend was or somebody related to me was working on. I have people who help me with the show and other shows that we cross promote and stuff. So you may have just stumbled upon something else, but
sure.
No, that wasn't me. I'm dedicated to the show, and what's coming next for me really is just I'm working on my next. I work usually on a couple episodes in advance, so I'm just working on my next three or four episodes, and that's what I've been busy with.
Oh, great. Well, people in the chat area here on YouTube have been pretty busy with all kinds of comments and thoughts and so forth. You've had a chance from time to time to be able to jump in there and add your two cents, so that's great to see that level of engagement taking place. But let's see, you've got a Patreon account set up. Do you want to maybe just tell people how that works and what, if they do check out your archives, how they can help support your show?
Yeah, so I have my regular show, Nighttime Podcast, which you can listen to for free on nighttimepodcast.com or iTunes. But as a way to support the show, I have, and by support, I mean pay for it and cover equipment and all that. I have a Patreon site, and Patreon, it's It's a website where you could support creators of different things. Like if I wanted to make a video game, I could go on Patreon and people could pay me and I'd make a video game and send it to them as an example. In my case, I make a podcast. So what it is it's, you can join on patreon.com/nighttimepodcast and it's $1 a month. And it basically, it gives you like insider access is the way to think about it is. So I do a separate episode every month that only the patrons, like the people who support my show can hear. And that episode is more like behind the scenes where yeah. I'll play like maybe things that were cut from interviews and or talk to guests that I didn't include in the original episode that you got for free. So mm-hmm. It's that, and all the money that I get from Patreon goes right back to the show. I run my show as a non-for-profit venture. So in months where if I have more money coming in than I need, I generally will buy something like swag, like t-shirts or stickers or whatever, and I just send it to the people that support me. And what else I do is my show has ads in it occasionally. And when you have an advertisement on a podcast, generally the advertiser sends you their products to sample it. But I don't use them. I just send them to my patrons. So this month, my sponsor is called Blue Apron. And that's like you sign up for it and they mail you food and meals and recipes and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So they sent me samples. But what I do is I just raffle it off to my patrons and draw a name and let them try it and tell me what it's like. So I try to give back to my patrons. So if people are interested in my show, yeah, $1 a month isn't a big deal. And that's enough that I have enough patrons pitching in $1 a month. So it just pays for everything. And it makes it so that I don't have to put like 3 or 4 ads in my show. And I don't have to worry about if I need to go somewhere or get a piece of equipment or something. I can just do it.
That's a great concept. Yeah, with the promotional events, as you're saying, Blue Apron. I thought we might have included that picture in the slideshow. But also the way that you offer exclusive content, too. So that's one of the things that we're doing here and working on better developing and implementing as well. So finally, just any last website plugs or upcoming dates, specials, anything you want really, you know, people to pay attention to outside of the dropping by your website to see what's going on, something that maybe kind of breaking news?
No, well, really all I would say is anyone who hasn't listened to my show, if it sounds like something you'd like, if you're into mysteries, true crime, paranormal stories, I'd recommend checking out my show. A good episode to start with, I would say, if you're into true crime, would be the episode called Murder at McDonald's. It's a 3-part series about a robbery gone wrong at a McDonald's restaurant in my hometown. That is probably my most popular true crime story. If you're into mysteries, my 3-part series on Emma Filipov and her disappearance that I talked about earlier, that is one that a lot of people got into. And if you're into paranormal, especially if you're into UFOs as I am, I really enjoyed the 2-part series on the Shag Harbor UFO sighting, which people call it Canada's Roswell. The 2-part series that I did on that, a lot of people into ufology enjoyed that. So I would just say check my show, and I love to hear from people. So if your listeners want to check it out and have something to say to me, they can email me at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com or contact me through my website, nighttimepodcast.com. So that's what I'd like to plug.
Excellent. That's exactly what we were hoping to hear. So that's a great way of doing it. Very straightforward. I'm not sure if you're going to have time to stick around for the Rogues Gallery end of things or not, but this is, once again, the exclusive part of the what we put together here on a weekly basis, where we transition on back behind the scenes for a more kind of open formatted approach. Although if the feature guest does join us, which typically they do, although, you know, and you, I mean, I would not blame you in the least if you've got it. It's, you know,
it's damn late.
Yeah,
it's damn late here.
But you know, thank you once again so much for joining us and being a part of things. This has been great, and I'm sure you've presented a lot of information here today that people had not heard of until tonight. So Friday the 13th, a special booking with Jordan Bone Party from Nighttime Podcast. What a better way to go to produce a show than that. So thanks once again, Jordan. We're going to be talking to Larry here in just a second, but happy sailing, my friend.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to listening to your show in the future. I think what you're doing is great, as I said, and it's very genuine and honest, and you guys are great. So keep up the great work, and thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
We'll talk to you again soon, eh?
sounds good, eh?
All right, man.
Okay. All right, so Pirate Larry, what? Just a quick recap, overview, just some thoughts there on the show.
Great show, Jaffe. Jordan was a great guest. I had a lot of information there, and there'd be a lot of links to follow up for people who, want to delve into this in more detail. I didn't realize they had a show on the History Channel, so I'm going to have to check out that those podcasts. But it's very interesting. All these things that are going on in Canada and having people on the ground locally to cover it in a real way. It's a great thing.
All right. And where are we off to tonight? We've been all over the place lately after coming back, making our way back from the Christmas break. But the YouTube live chat, once again, it seems to be quite busy there with some of the regular listeners. What do you figure? I'm not sure if I caught anyone shouting out any requests there, but I feel like a little of the Mossy Wench maybe tonight. How does that sound?
Yeah, it's a Mossy Wench night, definitely. We'll meet everybody over at the Mossy Wench after the show.
All right, Pirate Larry, done deal. Thanks for being dropping by and being a part of things again tonight. Let's not just to remind people. It looks like Larry will not be with us with next week's show. We're going to have James West sit in instead, so people might want to pay attention to that. Be sure to join us next week when at the same time when we play host to one of Minds.com's. As well as the Robin Hood's latest crew member additions, Aussie-based street-traveling musician and raconteur, Lord Stompy. So until we meet again out on the high digital seas, this has been episode 45 of Pirate Radio Podcast. On behalf of the ship, all its crew, and avid listeners, I'm your Chief Communications Officer, Jaffe Ryder, wishing you all a very merry... Bon voyage.